4. The main opposition. Between the forms of attack on, or resistance to, the faith which are retiring exhaust its survivals in new forms not yet fully developed but only beginning to appear in new arrivals stand, at any one moment in history, the main opponents of the day. This main opposition of the moment has, as I pointed out on an earlier page, varied astonishingly in character from one age to another, so much so that we find it hard to realize what that world must have been like in which the terrifying conqueror of Christians was the Mohammedan, or in which, some centuries later, in enthusiasm for general damnation and for a Moloch god led to so intense an offensive against the Catholic Church because she defended beauty and joy. These main oppositions in the past have all arisen as new arrivals, all passed at last through the state of becoming survivals and on to a later stage of oblivion. But each in its moment was supreme. The main opposition of any movement is characterized by its confidence. It doubts not of its victory, for it takes its truth for granted and therefore its strength. The survivals are conscious of defeat, the new arrivals are still timid, but the main opposition is hearty in attack. It feels its own success to be part of the nature of things, and, to the certitude of the Catholic which is faith, it opposes an equal counter-certitude often so fixed and habitual that it is hardly aware of its own limited character. Thus in the old days when the Bible Christian was a main opponent, he produced his creed and its conclusions with a simplicity born of complete confidence. Your confessional is an absurd and degrading excrescence. It is a fraud, for I find no confessional boxes in my family Bible. Your doctrine of purgatory and of an applicable fund of merit is nonsense. It is not in my family Bible. To support it you have had to drag in Maccabees, which I see is not in my Pucca Bible but only part of my Apocrypha. It was no good telling him that we didn't accept his premises, that we did not admit the authority of a literally interpreted text of his own choosing. He did not believe us. He thought it impossible that to any man this Bible of his, as read by himself, should not be the final court of appeal. Today that attitude looks comic, but it was no more comic in the time of its power than nationalism is comic today. We saw the same thing with scientific negation in the hour of its greatest strength. It was quite unquestionable to it that metric truth alone was true. It was the same thing with the old dead deism in its day and with that older Protestant doctrine, the divine right of kings. It was the same thing with reference of all things to an imaginary primitive church. This test of confidence and success applies today to those great forces which between them make up the main opposition of our time. There are three: nationalism, anti-clericalism, and what I will call, for so it calls itself, the modern mind. It is these three, singly or in combination, which occupy the energies of Catholicism today in its battle for continuance and triumph. It is to be remarked that none of these three is a doctrinal opponent, no, not even anti-clericalism. None of them prepares in said terms as did the materialist, the scientific monist, the anti-Catholic historian, a thesis which clashes with the thesis of the Catholic Church. None of them has a direct preoccupation with her dogma. The mark of today's saint main opposition, differentiating it from nearly all the perils of our Christian past, is that it propounds no explicit heresy. Its conflict with the faith is a conflict of mood. It is a conflict following on a certain mentality, not on any body of propositions. In the case of all the old heresies, a definite series of propositions came at the origin of the affair. A conflict of moods followed. An anti-Catholic habit of mind was produced, with all its consequences in a myriad social customs and in all the atmosphere of a society, but at the root lay perfectly clear doctrinal postulates which could be discussed in the abstract and accepted or denied without reference to their possible indirect effects. We all know what Calvinism is in the concrete, what is meant by a Puritan tradition in any society, and we instinctively reject it with disgust as we reject a repellent taste or smell. But the doctrines of Calvinism were not vague ideas slowly distilled from such a society in long process of years. They were formulated before the concrete Puritan came into existence, and they were the cause of him. They were laid down in black and white: the denial of free will, the consequent valuelessness of works, the foundation of church government and popular election, the denial of sacerdotal powers, the contempt for holy poverty and the laudable pursuit of wealth, etc. With each section of the main opposition today, it is the other way about. You may by prolonged analysis extract from its moods its ultimate principles, But the moods do not start from those principles. Their victims are not conscious of any such principles. When presented with them, they will often, and honestly, deny them to be held. The main opposition to Catholicism in our time, then, is not of like kind with ourselves. We need it as an obstacle rather than as enemy fire. It is not an armed body, recognizable by its uniform and having for its direct object our destruction. It is rather a difficulty of terrain. It is a number of mental states, affections, policies, ignorances under which Catholicism is indirectly menaced, or stifled, or deflected or weakened in its action on human society. Even anti-clericalism is not a doctrinal attack. It is a political thing and does not of itself challenge any dogma. It professes, and in such of its adherents as are sincere, sincerely professes to do no more than delimit the line beyond which the Catholic hierarchy exceeds its functions and invades a civil field where it has no right to act. So with nationalism, the ardent patriot does not challenge any doctrine of the Church, nor, qua patriot, feel opposed to her. On the contrary, when the faith is the national religion, particularly of an opposed nationality, it is most ardently supported and even treated sometimes as a test of civic devotion. While as for the poor modern mind, though anti-Catholic in essence, it has not the intellectual power to frame the simplest creed. It does but meander on, often quite ignorant of the Church's and whereabouts, and when it blunders into us, its first feelings are a mixture of grievance at our having bumped it and of apology for having got in the way. Individuals attached to one or more of these three moods, nationalism, anti-clericalism and the modern mind, are often led into direct and personal hatred of the Catholic Church because that organization has clashed with the object of their devotion. Such often and with a special preoccupation of hatred which takes the place of their older allegiance, and they become more concerned with the destruction of Catholicism than with the preservation of their country or the defense of lay rights or their delight in that repose of not thinking, which is the modern mind saint a special lure and value for a weary man. But the three moods themselves are not specifically and consciously anti-Catholic. They are not so by definition nor to their own knowledge. They appear so only indirectly and usually by reaction against Catholic effort or advance. Lastly, let it be noted that our main opposition today powerfully affects Catholics themselves, coloring all our time. It cannot but tinge the Catholic body therein present. It has always been so. If in the 16th and 17th centuries, when that doctrine of devotion to owns and prince now forgotten was of the main opposition, you challenged a Catholic and said, "Yes or no, do you repudiate your sovereign saint authority because it is in such a point opposed to the Church?" That man, though holy and even zealous, would shift uneasily. He was often at a loss to reply. He would do all in his power to reconcile the two opposing powers of crown and church, prelates as admirable as Gardiner, Bishop of Winchester, soldiers as admirable as Bayard, the noblest Catholic knight of his time. Five came down on the wrong side of the hedge. So also Jansenism, though working within the Church, was a wave from the mighty tide set flowing by the dark genius of Calvin. This affecting of Catholics today by the spirits of nationalism, yes, and of anti-clericalism itself, even to their shame, by something so much beneath their level as the modern mind, I shall deal with under each of these heads. It is a principal cause of weakness in our position throughout the world. Nationalism. I take first of the three elements in our modern main opposition nationalism. I do so because it is common to the Catholic and Protestant cultures, is everywhere apparent, and can everywhere be understood. Further, I take it first because of the three it is as yet the least overtly at issue with the faith. Finally, I take it first because it will probably, at long last, be the first to yield. Anti-clericalism will fight fiercely in all the coming battles, and is so much a necessary byproduct of Catholic society that the more the faith grows, the stronger grows this peril. As for the modern mind, nothing can deal with it but dissolution. It is like a huge heap of mud which can only be got rid of by slow washing away. It will be the last of the three to remain as a survival. But nationalism, in the sense in which I use the term here, the intense nationalism of our day, though it has yet some margin for increase, cannot maintain its present energies for more than a couple of lifetimes at the most, and probably hardly for so long. This nationalism is an exaggerated and extreme mood from which all the white world suffers today. It has all the marks of a religion, not of a full religion in the sense of a creed accompanied by a ritual and a developed ethical doctrine, but of a religion in the aesthetic sense, in the sense of that which in a religion exalts the emotions, prompts to sacrifice, ensures enthusiastic support, of a religion in the sense of devotion to an object of worship, worship passionate to the point of men's ain't sacrificing all they have, all else they love, and life itself, without question, to the thing adored. In this it is that conflict exists potentially, always and everywhere, between nationalism and the Catholic Church. In this it is that conflict has already arisen, and may in the near future arise much more strongly. For there is no room for two religions in any man's saint mind. Of any two loyalties one must take precedence over the other. And religion that is, the recognition of the ultimate reality, the adoration of that for which everything else must be sacrificed, is a mood of affection such that it will bear no equal rival. There can be no doubt that today nationalism has acquired the strength of religion, and of a religion which, in the minds of nearly all men, rivals, and in the minds of perhaps most men, quite eclipses, the religion called Catholic. But before we go further, it is important to define exactly in what sense we are using our words and what exactly is this nationalism which is today so different from anything Christendom has known in the past, and why it is part of what today most vitally opposes the religion of our race. There is here an ambiguity into which it is easy to fall, and which one must beware of. Patriotism has always existed, and always will, so long as men are bound in societies. One may feel that emotion of loyalty towards a tribe or a town, a tiny district, a feudal group and lord, a large nation or a whole vast culture, but it is always present, and always must be present, for if it were not, society could not hold together. Now, men must live in society, and therefore by every law of man's sane nature, that of self-preservation, that of the organ arising to supply the need, etc., devotion to what the Greeks call the city must be present. One may go much further and say that in sound morals, patriotism must not only be present in every society, but should be strong, because the absence of it is inhuman and unnatural, and even the weakness of it a degradation to the individual, a dereliction in the duty which he owes to himself and to that which made him, for we are the products each of his own country. But the essence of nationalism, in its present form as a menace to religion, lies in this, that the nation is made an end in itself. When that mood appears, there is present, in the strictly technical sense of the word, heresy, there is present false doctrine, and all the dangers of spreading and ramifying evil which spring from false doctrine as from one poisonous seed. Now, this making of the nation an end in itself is a heresy rampant throughout our European culture and its plantations overseas in the New World. It has all that flaming enthusiasm which marks the spring of such upheavals. It is as violently alive as was Islam in its first charge, or the fury of the early Reformation. Only, men are so used to it that they do not perceive its enormity. Let us take a few tests and judge by them the quality of the thing. Here is one. Modern men boast that they do not persecute opinion. That is, they do not seek out mere expression of opinion and punish it when it disagrees with the official opinion. They make that boast in connection especially with varieties of transcendental doctrine. The boast is vain, because they do not punish an opinion which operates to the denial or perversion of our ancestral religion. They proceed to the unreasonable and untenable idea of universal toleration and assure you that they chastise no expression of thought, let alone silence it, which is as much as to say that they hold nothing sacred. They malign themselves. Men still have the idea of sanctity, though misplaced. And here is a test. Go to a public park on two successive Sundays. On the first, stand upon a chair and declaim at length against the discipline of religion, ridicule the doctrine of the Trinity, the Incarnation, the right of a Christian society to enforce the practice of Christian ritual. Nothing will happen to you. On the second Sunday, get up on a chair and declaim at equal length and with equal zeal against the country and its conduct in the late war. Praise enthusiastically some more specially unpopular foreigners' enemies for choice. Laugh at the heroism of the troops. Call them cowards and go on to denounce with vigor the obedience rendered to their officers and soldiers and sailors. A great number of things will happen to you. Even after the police have rescued you from the hands of the mob, the state will proceed to deal with you in a fashion which will enlighten you for good upon the limits of toleration. Again, when the nation is in active peril, as in time of a really dangerous war, men who lessen the power of national resistance by denouncing the war, however rationally, are severely punished. That is quite right. But if there be any doubt as to which of the two religions is predominant, we have but to note the complete immunity of those who similarly denounce Christian effort as evil and who support its opponents. The distinction is apparent in many other ways. Thus, when men have lost faith, they are never weary of denouncing the frauds which may arise from zeal in religion. They are particularly insistent upon the stark necessity for exact and invariable truth on all occasions. They never weary of denouncing the casuists who have examined on what rare occasions it may be possible to conceal the truth without sin. But let a modern nation be at war, and the most honorable of men will stoop unhesitatingly to the most flagrant falsehoods in the pursuit of what is called propaganda. Under the effect of nationalism, a chivalric and sensitive man will tell any lie or assume any disguise. He will act in the capacity of a spy, he will lure the enemy's agents to their death, he will disseminate the most enormous myths upon enemy actions, and all this without suffering a sense of dishonor. This novel religion of nationalism, this making of the nation an end in itself, has had among other lamentable results the splitting up of our common cultural tradition, our general quality as Europeans, into a number of isolated fragments which do not lament their division as an accident to be remedied, but glory in it as a thing to be increased by all means in their power. The situation is grotesque to any man with the sense, or even the mere knowledge, of the past. It is tragic, a sort of murder of Christendom. Our various tongues are not bridged as they once were by a common use of Latin, and the divisions between them are not a negative force. Their divergence is actively emphasized by every device. The national language is imposed by force upon minorities. In the same spirit, transport and commerce are everywhere impeded by frontier walls. An army of men are lost to production, and wasted in checking and taking toll of all movements between state and state in what once was Christendom. And perhaps the worst effect of all, that very conception of Christendom upon which the continuance of our civilization depends, is effaced. Your politician, when he talks in terms of nations, thinks of Japan as he would of Italy, one rigid unit in an uncoordinated mechanical jumble of separate isolated peoples. But how, it may be asked, does all this come into conflict with Catholicism? That it is inimical to the general culture which Europe has inherited from the Catholic Church is obvious, but that is in effect only indirectly hostile to the faith. Where can direct hostility come in? There are two main ways in which such a conflict is developed, or perhaps by a subdivision of the second way three. First, it interferes with the universality of Catholicism. Secondly, it lends to national ends functions which are essentially religious, such as the teaching of morals, the presentation of true history and geography a department of morals, the choice of literature, and above all the general education of the young. In this last department, the general education of the young, the conflict is so serious that, as I have said, the thing might properly be made a separate third example of the conflict between nationalism and the church. In the first of these, the interference of nationalism with Catholic universality, the evil is not clearly apparent upon the surface. The nations have for the most part hesitated to thrust their divisions into the framework of the church. It is true that each nation has a national clergy and hierarchy, a principle not too Catholic, and also that each exercises some slight pressure greater in societies of Catholic culture than of Protestant upon the appointment of the church saint ministry, particularly of bishops. It is also true that in the relations of each nation to foreign Catholic religions, that is, monks and nuns in its midst, there still remains a good deal of give and take. Even during the war there was some measure of exception made for the universal, or as it was called, the international quality of the church. It is also true that nationalism has, as yet, produced no formidable schism, as yet no excessive national feeling has broken the discipline of unity within the official body of the church, and it may even be fairly surmised that nationalism will never be strong enough in our time to create a situation so disastrous. For we have had before our eyes during now so many generations, such a lesson in what follows upon the loss of unity, that the most enthusiastic of Catholic nationalists fight shy of establishing new independent national churches. But it remains true that nationalism has divided the church today into very sharply defined regions. For instance, One can point to territories which changed hands after the last war, and in which, as a result, the local hierarchy was at once changed, as though it were a part of national officialdom. Yet, I repeat, on the surface the evil of excessive nationalism as affecting the universality of the Church has not strikingly appeared. Its effects have been slight so far. In the second department, that of letters and of the official attitude towards history and geography, contemporary and of the past, and especially the education of the young, it is another matter. There the effect of nationalism comes in very strongly indeed, and there are already districts in which a clash between it and the very minimum required by the faith has taken place. Nationalism has, among other evils, bred that of a powerful bureaucracy in each state, a rigid centralization, and a deplorable uniformity within each frontier exactly corresponding to the violent contrast between either side of the frontier. The worship of the nation has been able to make men tolerate under its authority what they could never have tolerated from princes, a submission to rule, which, through sumptuary laws on food and drink, through conscription, through a cast-iron system of compulsory instruction for all on state-ordered lines, and through a state examination at the gate of every profession, has almost killed the citizen's ain't power to react upon that which controls him, and has almost destroyed that variety which is the mark of life. In the field of compulsory state instruction especially has nationalism come in conflict with Catholicism.